So, yeah, with your permission, I wanted to dedicate the shiur today. This year coming up, Chol Hamoed Pesach will be the Rav's 25th yahrzeit. I passed away in 1993, Chol Hamoed Pesach. And it's very hard for me to read the first aliyah of Chayei Sara without thinking of the Rav and a very, very important essay that he wrote, an essay that continues to reverberate over now half a century after it was written, an essay called Confrontation, in which the Rav gives his sense of the proper approach Jewish people should have towards interacting with the world in general terms, and then with specific application to what is referred to as interfaith dialogue. The church had been undergoing some major transformations, what in total are referred to as Vatican II, where the church was revisiting some fundamental doctrines, especially those that related to the relationship between the church and the Jewish people. And there was a considerable amount of effort that was being invested into organizing this interfaith dialogue. And the Rav was asked to give his view of the topic, which we'll get to. And he developed it based on the first aliyah in this week's parsha, Avram's encounter with the B'nai Ches, specifically in the context of his beloved wife Sarah's passing. The section of the Torah is remarkable for many reasons, including that Avram is referred to as a Nisi Elokim, where a person who began his journey standing alone, Avram Ha'ivri, Kol Olam Kulo Me'ever Echad, Avihu Me'ever Hasheni, and Avram is now referred to as Nisi Elokim, where his message has been largely recognized by the pagan society around him, which itself is a great achievement, number one. Number two, that Avram has a very complex encounter and dialogue with the B'nai Ches and their erstwhile leader, a man named Ephron, and he has this all literally, Vayakum Avraham Me'al Pnei Meso, at the most bereaved and aggrieved moment in his life, that he was able to conduct himself with such composure and such dignity and such nuance at this time is itself a remarkable achievement. You would have forgiven him for being beside himself, and to have to enter an extremely delicate negotiation, a negotiation that had very profound implications for himself, for his legacy, at this time is something of a great achievement. Just to contrast it for a moment, Moshe Rabbeinu's sin, the sin that will do him in, the sin of Mei Miriva, where Moshe, let's say, hits the rock or speaks in anger to the Jewish people, it can't be lost on us that that happens right after the death of his beloved sister Miriam. Moshe was in an emotionally aggrieved state, and it shows in his reaction. And here for Avram to maintain his composure throughout this very complex interchange is itself something extremely remarkable. And then one third reason, especially because in the yeshiva this year we're studying Masach the Kiddushin, so I thought I would introduce this point, simply to give people an appreciation of one of the ideas that many of the students here are encountering right now, but it's a very important point. There are three different ways of initiating a Jewish marriage. The first stage of Jewish marriage is referred to as Kiddushin or Erusin. One can initiate through intimate activity. That's not a method that we use anymore. Even in the times of the Gemara says that that was invalidated, essentially, as approached by a man named Rav, that he would give lashes to somebody who initiated Kiddushin or Erusin through intimate activity. The other method is a shtar, is to use a legal document. That itself is not used, though the Gemara itself does not invalidate that. But the approach that everybody here knows is used is kesef, or shvei kesef, to be more precise. That is to say, something that had an object of value. And there are reasons that we use as a plain ring. Tosfos and Kiddushin and Daf Tes deals with that issue. So the Gemara tries very hard to figure out, and struggles a little bit, to be honest, to figure out what the source is for Kiddushei Kesef, the fact that one can initiate the first stage in Jewish marriage, again, kiddushin or erusin through the use of kesef. And the Gemara has a number of suggestions, one of which is what's referred to as a gezeira shava, which means you have similar words in different parts of the Torah. The Torah describes kiddushin. I can use the term the mitzvah of kiddushin, though that itself is subject to some controversy. Not everybody's of the view that it's actually a mitzvah, but the Torah says in the 24th chapter of Sefer Dvarim, ki yikach ish isho ve'Allah. So that term, ki yikach, when a man will take a woman, is understood to be a reference to marriage. So this word which is used by the Torah of kicha is used in actually this week's parsha. When Avram is purchasing the burial ground for Sarah, it says, natati kesef hasadeh kach mimeni. He says to Ephron, I'd like you to take the money. Avram paid a great deal of money, arbameo shekel kesef over la socher. He paid a great deal of money for the burial ground, not just for the cave, but for the field in which the cave was located. And the Gemara says, so we know, if the Torah says about marriage, ki kach ish isha, okay, that uses one language of kicha, and then it says in Parshas Chayisara, natati kesef hasadeh, kach mimeni, so just as in the instance in Chayisara, kesef was used to mediate that transaction, it must be that when it comes to ki kach ish isha, that the Torah was alluding to the usage of kesef in the marriage transaction. So this is a very fascinating thing, and any time that the Gemara has Xerishava, sometimes students don't understand that it's not just a word game, but there are deep concepts that the Torah is revealing to us. It's certainly not an accident, certainly not an accident, that the source for initiating a marriage is the fact that Avram took it upon himself to purchase the single best burial ground that he could for his wife. That is to say, if you really want to understand the way that a marriage is initiated, look at the commitment that Avram and Sarah had to each other. And the fact that Avram wouldn't simply, you know, say, okay, we'll bury her wherever we can find a place to bury her, but paid such careful attention to the place that she would be buried and its symbolic value tells us a lot about what one should be thinking about when one initiates a marriage. That is to say, the kind of a lifetime commitment. I hesitate to mention this Gemara lest it be misunderstood, but the Gemara in Kiddushin and Daf Yud Gimel struggles mightily to justify the idea that after one's spouse has passed away, that one can indeed remarry. So thank God we do believe in remarriage, but the Gemara struggles with the idea. Perhaps we should look at marriage always as a lifetime commitment, and if the spouse simply passes away, okay, so that means that the marriage has now come to its end, but it doesn't mean that there's necessarily a possibility for remarriage. So thank God that's not the accepted halachic ruling, but the fact that the Gemara could even consider that suggestion, that Hava Mina, really highlights and underscores this point of a lifetime commitment. And Avram and Sarah certainly in their own way reflected that. Avram, his purchase of the burial ground for Sarah is, in fact, one of the major sources that we look to for the initiation of Jewish marriage. What did it represent? What did the burial ground for Sarah represent? So the Rav explained so beautifully that Avram understood that what was really at stake was not merely the question of where is my wife going to be buried? Is she going to be buried in, you know, area 15 of the cemetery or area 17, block A, block B, the Maimonides section, the Moses Montefiore section. For those of you who have been in Jewish cemeteries, they all basically have the same names and sections. So the Rav explained is that Avram understood that this was a question of legacy. And this very generous and gracious offer that the B'nai Chet, the indigenous people, make to him, that Nisya Elokim Ata B'tochenu B'mivchar Kivarenu Kivores Meisacha, you should bury your wife in the best of our graves, was at once a very generous offer, but one that was out of the question. Because Avram needed to make it absolutely clear that the legacy that he had initiated together with Sarah, and let's not forget that Avram and Sarah were full partners in the enterprise of ethical monotheism, Es HaNefesh, Asher Asu V'Charan, Avram Megayer Es HaNashim, Sarah Megayer Es HaNashim, that they were partners in this mission, in their educational mission for the world. Avram understood that Sarah could not be buried simply in a pagan graveyard, but she needed to be buried apart. And the Rav looked to the expression that Avram Avinu used when he said to the B'nai Chet, in response to their very generous and sincere and gracious offer, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, that I have a dual identity in my confrontation with you. And the Rav said what it means is as follows. Ger v'toshav, have opposite connotations, and I am both at once. Ger literally means a stranger. Ki gerim hayisem be'aretz Mitzrayim. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. That's why ve'ahavtem es hager. You should extend love to somebody who literally is a stranger, and certainly to somebody who converted to Judaism, as it's understood halachically. But ger, I am a stranger. I am not naturally one of you. I will always be somewhat apart. And at the same time, toshav, I dwell amongst you. And so the Rav explained that there, our attitude towards the world has to be understood through this dialectic. That on the one hand, we are very much a part of this world, and we share in all of the suffering of humanity. We share in the commitment to advance society through technology and scientific research. We have a great concern about any kind of human suffering, as I alluded to just a moment ago. That is our toshav dimension. But as far as ritual matters are concerned, and certainly this includes burial, but is not limited to burial, there our posture is one of ger. There we see ourselves as apart. We're not simply going to modify our own unique religious commitments, our ritual commitments, to whatever the prevailing culture is. And that Avraham initiated this dialectic. Avraham, of course, was the Ava Chesed. He was open to the world on all four sides of his tent. But he also understood very well that he had to maintain a certain distance, especially as far as religious matters were concerned. And thus the Rav said that interfaith dialogue, were it to occur, could only deal with general human questions, but no doctrinal, dogmatic, or specifically ritual questions. That had to be under the category of ger. And I encourage everybody to take a look at that seminal essay, which continues to be extremely relevant, like I said, even half a century after it's written. If I might be so bold, I simply wanted to expand on the Rav's seminal chiddush with two very brief observations about the first Aliyah of Chayisar, where I think that one really appreciates. The Rav didn't mention either of these observations, but I think we could even build on what he said. You know, you could ask the following question. You know, Avram doesn't just purchase the Maras HaMachpelah, but anybody know what he purchases as well? Just mentioned this very briefly, but the pasuk says, "Natati kesef hasadeh kach mimeni." Avram didn't only buy the cave, but he bought the field. And the Torah emphasizes on three different occasions that he bought not just the cave, but the field. Well, why do you think he bought the field? So Dasi says a geder, that it wasn't enough simply to have the cave, but you needed the space around it. And I think this is replete with symbolic value. If having a separate burial ground in the Rav's telling was a way of saying that on matters of religious law, on matters of ritual and doctrine, and the basic dogmas of Judaism, we need to stand apart. So that also means that there needs to be a kind of an interstitial space, if you will, where you're not literally coming up boundary against boundary. What really mattered was the Maras HaMachpelah, but what was necessary was to have the Sadeh, to have the field all around it, to ensure that when that confrontation happens with general society, we do so on our own terms, and we do so with a certain birth, where we're not, you know, coming literally right up against the boundary of the cave, which represents our unique Jewish identity, but you need to have a certain degree of space around it. So if something is already a questionable area, it pays to err on the side of caution. So Avram wanted just a little bit of space. He didn't want Sarah's Maras HaMachpelah literally to be right next to some other grave. It really needed to be apart. And I see that as having literal meaning, but also a great symbolic meaning as well. Point number one. Point number two is that there's a certain word that appears in the context of the first Aliyah, which is some 17 psukim, if I remember correctly, 16 or 17 psukim, I believe 17. There's a word that Avraham and Ephron continue to throw back and forth at one another in this negotiation, and that is the word Shema'eni. Ach imatalu Shema'eni. In fact, the story concludes where it says, Vayishma Avraham el Ephron, that finally Avraham heard Ephron and was willing to go along. Vayishkol Avraham le Ephron et akesef. This root comes up six times. And certainly what it does not mean is, please listen to me, like they're having trouble with auditory processing. They could hear each other. They were talking to each other from a very close distance. But like we say in Shema Yisrael, doesn't mean that the Jewish people should hear as opposed to being my hearing impaired or incapable of actually hearing the or processing the sound waves, it means to internalize or to understand. And I think that this word appearing literally six times in this very short space of Psukim is actually the Torah's way, based on the Rav's analysis, of saying that when it comes to these matters, of trying to figure out, is this an area where cooperation is recommended? Or is this, on the other hand, an area where we need to stand apart? Is this an area, as it were, of ger? Is this an area of toshav? It requires a very, very careful listening. We have to understand the area very well. It's always easy to say one of two directions. Yeah, sure, we should cooperate about everything. Or, yeah, sure, we should build walls 100 feet high, made of cinder block, and have nothing to do. Those two approaches don't require very careful scrutiny. But if you're going to opt for the Rav's approach, which, of course, I think is the correct approach, then what is really required is exceptionally careful attention to detail. What is really being asked and what is really being suggested? Again, the critical shorish being the shorish of shama, to listen, to internalize, to pay very careful attention. Now, the very first thing that Moshe says to the Jewish judges when a Jewish judicial branch is set up, the first thing that Moshe says to them before he says, you know, you should issue righteous edicts and you shouldn't corrupt justice, the first thing he says is Shamoa ben Achechem. What you have to do primarily is to listen very, very well, because your job is a challenging one, where you have to discriminate who's right and who's wrong, who's chayav and who's pater. The first word that Moshe says to them in Sefer Dvarim, Shamoa ben Achechem ushvatetem tzedek. The key to coming up with the right answer is to first listen. You all tell your students over and again, you have to read the question to answer it correctly. You have to listen very, very carefully to be able to come up with the right approach. And thus, in this section, when we're dealing with an incredibly subtle issue of where do we cooperate and where do we separate ourselves, when are we geirim and when are toshavim, I don't think it's an accident that the Torah ends up saying that the critical faculty to have is the capacity of shmia, the capacity of understanding things very deeply. Now, as the Rav always emphasized, to understand things very well, that's the importance of having a broad education. Because you're not going to understand when it's an area where we should be cooperating, when in fact we have a responsibility, such as that it's permissible to cooperate, but we must cooperate. If you don't have the basic infrastructure of knowledge to know what's being discussed, you could just, it's easy to throw up your hands and say, well, we don't have anything to do with it. That's why a broad education is absolutely required if we're going to have a healthy and proper relationship with the rest of the world. I think what's so beautiful in the end, and with this we'll conclude, is the location of the Maras HaMachpelah. So the Torah emphasizes that it is Biktzei Sadehu. It is at the very edge of the field. That is to say, it was both a part of the broader field that was transacted, but it was also just off to the edge, Asher Biktzei Sadehu. And I understand this, again, in light of the Rav's analysis and confrontation, that is I think, deep with symbolic value. On the one hand, we stand apart, as we said, but there is the Maras HaMachpelah, Asher Biktzei Sadehu. It's right there, in the center where it would be, very, very far from its interaction point with the rest of the world, but it's at the edge of the field where there can be some possibility for interface under the right conditions. Again, not relating to anything ritual or dogmatic, as the Rav said in confrontation, but when it comes to basic questions of humanity, of advancing civilization, what he referred to by the Latin term caritas, generous giving, in making sure that human suffering was alleviated. All of these areas, the Jewish people are standing right by, on the edge, prepared and in fact obligated to help out. As the Rambam rules, I'll get to Linda in a second, the Rambam rules in a number of places in his Mishneh Torah that part of the mandate of Diracha, Darchei Noam, Bechol Netivotah, Shalom, and certainly the pasuk that we say every day in Ashrei, Tova Adonai Lakol, Virachamav Alkol Ma'asav, if the ways of the Torah are pleasant and that God has mercy on all of his creation, then surely we have to be merciful as well, and our ways have to be pleasant, not just when it comes to our immediate fraternity, but especially when it comes to those outside our Dalet Amot, outside our four cubits. And if this message was relevant, as it certainly was, when the specific question was being asked about interfaith dialogue after Vatican II, it continues to be extremely, extremely important. We live in a polarized world. where those who say we should be toshavim about everything, that they don't understand the concept of boundaries and geder, as Dasi spoke about just a minute ago, and that there should be essentially no distinction. On the other hand, there are those who believe only in 100-foot walls 20 feet thick, and our approach is a more challenging one. Our approach is to discriminate, to, as I said, shamoa, to listen very carefully, and to try to figure out what is healthy cooperation and what, unfortunately, risks compromising our most core identity. Those are always the hardest questions to figure out, but as is so often the case, perhaps the most fulfilling and enriching approach that we can have in this world is approach where we strive for synthesis. We strive to balance our own unique Jewish commitments with our human commitments. That's something that certainly our students need to be taught. They're going to struggle with this as well. Many of you saw the article that came out by a high school senior wondering whether, in fact, our community was striking the appropriate balance in this particular area. But despite the fact that it is quite difficult, does not mean that we should, in my view, that we should reevaluate our basic approach. We simply have to recommit ourselves to the process of shamoa, of very careful discrimination, to, you know, what are the areas of interface with a broader culture, and what are areas where, again, we need to stand apart. Ger v'toshav, anochi imachem. Yes, Linda.
From what I remember reading about the Rav, he would never speak.